The meeting will come to order. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of the January 24th meeting?
So moved.
Representative Faust moves approval of the minutes for the Wednesday, January 24th meeting. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. All right. Members, we are going to continue on then with the budget proposal in a moment, but first, staff member Greg Crowe has a couple of items in our packet that I'm going to call upon him to explain to us. Mr. Crowe.
Madam Chair and members, we've added two summary documents to your in your today's handout packet that you can put in your budget book that you might find useful, or maybe you want to take them home and read them. The first is a memo to committee members, and it's basically a summary of the budget, kind of a narrative form, so if you want to just skim through and see or have a place to review what the governor has in his budget. It's got some big picture numbers and then has detail for pretty much everything that's in the governor's budget. And just for your information, if there are other areas of the budget you're interested in, our department does these kinds of summaries, and we'll have that up on the web for the whole budget probably by Monday or Tuesday. So if you look on the Fiscal Analysis Department website, you'll see this kind of information for all subject areas that you might be interested in. Secondly, there's a one of the first printouts you'll see of many in your packet. Looks like this. Basically what this is a printout of the governor's proposed increase by school district by year 2008 and 2009. It's by per pupil. So for example, you see the basic formula increase is the state average is $100, and it's $100 for every school district. And then other general fund increases, the special ed increase, and then the total increase per pupil, and you can see what that is for each school district. This does not include the funding that the governor recommends for the high school initiative or the three-star successful schools initiative that isn't allocated out. You know, there's qualifications for getting that money, so there's no way to allocate that to individual districts. So you can kind of see what the minimum amount of general fund revenue that your school district or other school districts you're interested in would be getting in 2008 and 2009, and then mentally you can think about those other potential revenues and keep those in your mind. The Department of Education does have a distribution of, if everyone qualified for those, how much money would they get on their website, but this is just kind of what's sort of guaranteed under these programs in the governor's budget.
Thank you. So, members, you know, one of the things we always do when we see, unfortunately, one of the things we always do when we see any kind of proposals is we often go to our own districts and we see how did this come out for us and are we going to be for it or not. And, of course, we're all here to represent our districts, so we all have to do that, and I do it too. But when we come out with our final bill, I will implore every member of this committee to think beyond just your own district. You don't want your own district to get the shaft, and I'm sure none of us would want to be embarrassed by our own districts doing much better than any other district. But, you know, overall, we're going to be looking for a fair bill that, you know, is not harming any districts and is helping districts as fairly as possible, and I think this is the year when we can do that. And so I'm very, very partial to thoughts and ideas that benefit as many districts as possible, or districts on a fair basis if we're doing this bill for this type of district and this one for that. But this at least gives us, for the governor's shot, we can all look at our own districts. And then I have, before we get on to topics and looking at this, I wonder, Representative Garofalo, if you brought in your homework assignment.
Yeah. Oh, the photo itself? No, I did not bring that
up. Okay, well, then you've been rescued by our staff, Shannon Patrick, and in fact, yesterday while we were in the middle of the hearing, but we were so hard at work, I didn't want to interrupt, but at least Mr. Crow and I got to see the picture because he called it up on his computer, and we saw the beautiful picture of Representative Morgan, and it was in color. But since you didn't bring us in the color, I'm going to have to pass out the black and white. And so we'll start it around this way. And if you could please, when you get to the end, when we get back to Representative Marquardt, if you could just shoot it around over there, because I know everybody will want to see this. So here it goes. And no vandalism, Mr. Costa. No mustaches, no horns. Representative Morgan.
The word at Burnsville High School is that some friends of mine are currently involved in a name the caption contest. So perhaps Representative Swales would like to send an email down to Burnsville with some suggestions.
Uh-huh.
All right.
All right. Thank you. And we have a couple questions for Mr. Crow before we go to Dr. Melcher. Representative Hiscom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the percent increases, and I see that there's quite a range between, like, one something and some as high as 3 for 208, and then 209, some, you know, above 9. Because, again, I haven't been working with these spreadsheets before. Is that typical to have these big, what appears to be a big spread in percentages, and does that account for a very small amount of money, or... at the end of the day, is there really a large amount of money discrepancy between them as well?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it is fairly typical that there's some range around which the final numbers come out. If you look, the 2008 column is the one that has 1.8% at the top. That's the statewide average. So if you look at the top of any page, you see kind of in the middle, there's a percent increase, and it says 1.8 at the top. And if you look, then if we just kind of look on that page, the biggest increase is third from the bottom. Cass Lake School District has a 2.5% increase, and that is represented by $215 per pupil, their increase. And you can see that there is a formula in the other general program. It could be the transportation sparsity change, something along those lines that impacts them, you know, differently than other districts. It's not unusual to see a, you know, kind of a range like that. You'll generally see it clustered around the average unless there are some major changes in a big disequalizing program, or there's a lot of targeting of revenue in one particular category of pupils, or you know, any of those things we talked about when we went through the spreadsheet and we said, okay, here's basic and everybody gets the same, and then here's all these other things where people get different amounts. And if you pick any one of those and that gets more revenue targeted toward it, it's going to impact districts differently. Transportation sparsity or compensatory or equity, any number of those, if they have money allocated into them and nothing else does, you'll see kind of these variations. And the reason the numbers are bigger in 09, the 4% number, is the compounding effect, because it's relative to base. So in 09, with the 4% represents the 2% from the prior year plus another 2%. So the average 3.6 is the 1.8% average from the prior year, and then an additional 1.8% roughly for the second year.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add one other thing to keep in mind is that there are lots of charter schools and lots of small school districts, and so when we talk about the total money, there are a few very large school districts, and so oftentimes the distribution, 100 small school districts and charter schools could be very different from the average, but the majority of the students could be in districts that are all very close to the average. So don't forget about that distribution among school districts. So if you took the 5 or 6 largest school districts and looked at their change, that's going to tell you probably a lot more about the way the total money's looking and be much closer to the state average than a bunch of the little school districts. So I always keep that in mind. A lot of little districts could have very different results, but for the average student, there being very little difference.
And Madam Chair, if I could just piggyback on that, think about it in terms of the 5th and 95th concept that we talked about. It rarely does us any good to look at the outliers on the high and the low, because there's a few reasons because of the student populations in those districts, the size, as Mr. Strong was talking about, of those districts, and that those outliers can look really funny. And just for no reason related, you know, no real good reason. And so it's kind of good to have that 5th and 95th idea in your head and say, okay, well, how far is generally is that, you know, kind of standard deviation from the mean on the average increase?
And we do have a couple bills in already to take a look at that 95 and 5, and so we will be discussing all these topics even more. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was commenting because I represent four school districts, Anoka, Hennepin, Robbinsdale, Osseo, and Brooklyn Center, all kind of at both ends, and they're all below the average. So,
Representative Hillstrom, you're lucky. It's the people that get some of their districts benefited and some not that have trouble figuring out what to do. You know what to do. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, I have 13 school districts, and they're all below, too. So. But anyway, I think my question was answered by your question, the answer I got from Greg Rowe, that the categoricals that are receiving the 2% are also already in the spreadsheet. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is regards to the 2% that the governor was talking about and the 2% we've heard about in the press and everywhere, and yet the average state total average shows 1.8%. Is that Enron accounting, or is there a more logical explanation for that?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Faust, there's actually a logical explanation. The 2% is applied to the basic formula amount, which you remember is about $5,000. So applying that 2% to $5,000 gives you an added $100. If you look at the very top line, the current revenue average statewide is $7,600. So since the 2% is, for the most, I mean, it trickles through the other formulas, but for the most part, since it applies directly to the basic formula, 2% of 5,000 is not 2% of 7,621. So when you, if all that was on here was that $100, you divided that 100 into 7,641, you'd get a number of like 1.5% increase. So when you are thinking about putting money on the formula, the thing to remember is that putting 1% or 2% or the 4 and 4 that was put on 2 years ago doesn't drive a 4% increase in total funding. It's only tied to that particular component.
Representative House.
Yeah, follow-up question. So it would be much more accurate if we're talking about total increase in education funding to say the governor proposed a 1.8% increase.
No.
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair and Representative House, it would be accurate to say that the average increase as a result of the governor's changes is 1.8%, not including some of the other money that we don't know which school district it's going to end up in.
Right. Thank you.
Dr. Hester. And while he's coming up, as near as we can tell up here, he should be starting on page 69, and Deputy Commissioner Anderson, if that's not right, you can let us know. And then, members, one last thing from the former teacher and me. Don't forget you've got your colored pencils like Representative Dominguez and Representative Dietrich, so that because these books are permanent, we'll be working with them all during the session. And so if you want to take any notes or highlight things, it will make it easier for you later when we have bills on these topics, and you can go back in your notebook and remind yourself of what the governor proposed. Deputy Commissioner Anderson, are you starting, or Dr. Melcher?
Madam Chair, I will be starting today.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chaz Anderson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education. Starting off on page 69, this is Article 2. This is the Successful Schools Program. The governor recommends $75 million each year for this program to implement a one-time payment to schools based on earning at least 3 stars on the school report card in reading or math. How that works is that schools would receive between $90 per student and $150 per student, which is equivalent to about 1.5% to 2.5% for successfully earning at least 3 stars in reading or math on the school report card for the school years of 2006, 2007, and 2007-2008. Going on to page 71, this is the Math and Science Teacher Academy's recommendation. The governor recommends $2 million in fiscal year 08 and $4 million in fiscal year 09 to establish regional math and science teacher academies. These academies will assist teachers with professional development and training as it relates to our new math and science standards coming online. We have this proposal will, as I said, assist with professional development efforts. One of the efforts we've been really focused on the last 4 years is training and making, ensuring we have effective teachers in the classroom, and this service will help teachers with that. Going on to page 73, this is a recommendation for the Collaborative Urban Educator Grant Program. The governor is recommending $773,000 each year to increase funding for three programs that specifically work to support educator training and recruitment programs for individuals to meet the needs of urban school districts and diverse learning populations. Going on to page 75, this is an alternative school calendar program. The governor is recommending $2 million starting in fiscal year 2009 for a six-year pilot project to study the effectiveness of alternative school calendars. As you may know, there have been many proposals out there to extend the number of school days. Right now, the average school calendar is about 172 days. In looking at the cost of doing that, it would cost the state approximately $31 million for each day we would add to the calendar. And so adding days to the calendar is quite an expensive proposition, and so the governor is actually recommending that we take a look at an alternative salary, or I'm sorry, an alternative school calendar and study the issue to see if it's effective to move forward in future years. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have a difficult time with money being spent, no offense meant, in studies, when we can look at and we see that the state of Florida had year-round school, and they abandoned it. And there are other states that have messed around with this concept. So I would think that we can look at what other states have done within this area that would give us the results that we need. But anyways, it's just a thought. Thank you.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there any schools that are currently doing the 45-15?
Deputy Commissioner
Madam
Anderson.
Chair, Representative Faust, yes, I believe there's schools in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. Actually, and Woodbury, I learned recently.
Raleigh Crossing School.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Anderson.
Page 76 is the governor's recommendation for Mandarin Chinese program expansion. This is funding $250,000 each year to provide startup funds for school districts looking to move into Mandarin Chinese programs for their school districts. Just some background on this program. In 2006, the legislature allocated $250,000 per year to assist with putting together a K-12 articulated curriculum for Mandarin Chinese, and also a working group that is going to set forth recommendations very shortly to the legislature. This is just building on that proposal, as the department has seen a great interest from a lot of school districts in expanding these world language programs. Going to page 78, this is a recommendation for the Minnesota Reading Corps program. The governor is recommending $1 million each year to expand the Minnesota Reading Corps program at the St. Croix River Education District, otherwise known as SCRED. This program is conducted in partnership with Serve Minnesota, which is Minnesota's AmeriCorps program. And this program has seen some really good reading results, and also could potentially leverage federal funding through the federal AmeriCorps program. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually had a question about the Mandarin Chinese expansion. Is there only additional funding for the expansion of Mandarin Chinese? I thought during the State of the State, the governor talked about world languages. So is it only one world language that we're really funding here? Or
Deputy Commissioner Anderson. Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. This is only for the Mandarin Chinese world languages. I think the State of the State may have been referring to a recommendation to require 4 years of world languages during one's career in K-12 education or during a specific period of time. It wasn't specifically for funding for world language programs.
And then I have a question. Hilstrom, were you finished?
I'm finished.
Okay. There, question back on the great minds think slowly, I guess. Hilstrom was one topic back. I'm two topics back. For the alternative schools money, is that available only for new initiatives or for those existing schools such as those you named?
Madam Chair, that would be available for interested schools that would want to enter into a six-year pilot to go into an alternate school calendar. So it would be for new schools, not existing.
Thank you. All right, what page are we on now?
I believe we are next on page 79, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a recommendation, $2.220 million for each fiscal year to expand what's called the Minnesota First Five New Teacher Induction Program. This program will focus on mentoring and assisting new teachers to the profession in hard to fill subject areas, license areas, which includes right now math, science, world languages, and special education in Minnesota, and also hard to staff schools. We're finding in many rural parts of the state, it's not even the specific licensor shortage, but it's a teacher shortage. We've found that in northwest, northeast, and southwest Minnesota. And so this program would work to recruit and retain new teachers into the classroom. Minnesota's data is not that much different from the national data, which shows that about 50% of teachers leave the profession within the first 5 years. So what this program is really focusing on is making sure that we can retain our teachers in those hard-to-fill license areas and hard-to-staff schools.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry about asking the question later. Going back to page 78, my understanding is that we used to have funding, I think, for AmeriCorps in the past. And my question is, how much money had we spent, if you have any idea? I know it's a tough question. I know that we did spend some money in the past. The other question I have, I know this is a good program, but I remember meeting with folks having to do with AmeriCorps, but I know there's a federal match with it as well. This is one of the few areas in which we can get federal monies to match equally. I think it is one-on-one. Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Deputy Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, there is a separate state appropriation for Serve Minnesota. I'm not sure of the amount. I'd have to check that for you. You're right, there is a federal match whenever we spend state money for the program. I'm not certain as to the match requirements. I'd have to get you that information. But I believe it's formula-based at the federal level, and it depends on when they re-up funding every year for the program. But this money would leverage some federal money if we were to adopt this recommendation.
Is there a possibility, I think, Madam Chair, of using this money in any way associated with, remember we talked about the consortium of schools that's using money to try to keep students from being earmarked special ed? Is there a possibility, I think it's K through 3, right, that it's used for right now? And that would, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Heidgerken, the general appropriation, I'd have to have served Minnesota talk about how they use that funding. They have they're their own entity with their executive director, and I'm sure they'd love to let you know how they spend the money. But on this appropriation, we're specifically earmarking for the SCRED literacy model, and that actually they have some results that show they have been able to keep students out of special ed by doing early intervention. So this is that program.
Yeah. And then, members, I would just let you know, too, because I know we have a lot of new members on this committee. When we're just getting an overview now on this topic. We're going to actually hear the governor's bill, and some of it will be, there'll be individual bills, or it could be some overarching bills. But we'll be having these topics again, and when we actually have the topics, there may be resource people then when we're on that specific topic that will come forward. So this is not the only time we get to find out about these ideas. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that in mind, I'll make this question very brief. It's back to the five new teacher induction. Deputy Commissioner, do we have research that indicates to us the reasons why teachers are leaving the teaching profession within 5 years?
Deputy Commissioner Anderson.
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, there's lots of reasons why they leave. Sometimes it's a lack of support. Sometimes it's a lack of the salary issue. Sometimes it's layoffs. They can't find another job because of particularly areas where we have more teachers, the supply is higher than the demand, particularly as elementary teachers have difficult times finding jobs. It could be for just personal reasons. So there's a lot of reasons and research that we can certainly give you, but it's not just one particular reason, but there's several.
Great, thank you.
Representative Anzels, Representative Demmer, and then Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to Representative Heidgerken's question regarding federal financial participation for AmeriCorps, can we be confident that we are maximizing federal dollars in every program area?
Deputy Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, and actually we have an answer for Representative Heidgerken's question. It's $900,000 a year that is appropriated to serve Minnesota, which is Minnesota's program. The more money we would put into this program, the more federal dollars we would leverage. We are not maximizing our leverage for this particular program. As for other education programs, I'd have to take them one by one, but typically the state has not maximized its matching. It could get more additional federal dollars for this program.
Representative Mandel.
Madam Chair, thank you for your candor. That, I can anticipate, will be an issue that we'll have to continue to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This goes back to Representative Morrow's question regarding the reasons. Is there a breakdown as to whether it's more elementary or more middle or more high school teachers that we have larger turnover, or is it pretty uniform across the spectrum?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, shortly the Board of Teaching and the Department of Education will be releasing its annual teacher supply and demand report. I don't know the exact new data. It's something we release on the 15th of February. And so certainly we could come back and give you more detailed and licensed areas where we see the need for more support for new teachers and where we see an oversupply of teachers. But that's a report that we do with the Board of Teaching, and we would be happy to present that report when it's ready. I've not even seen the results of that data, so I don't want to make any comment on it yet.
Thank you. It sounds like we have another hearing topic, Madam Chair.
Like I said, we're going to be going into the evening by the end of the session, I am sure. Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, we're on legislature.
Representative Mariani, are you trying to make yourself more popular than you are?
But this all sides to that as well. Deputy Commissioner, I'm just looking at the language in the 5-minute teacher induction, and it says to form partnerships. We see the same language earlier in the math and science teacher academies. So the intent would be not to deliver grants to a school district per se, but encouraging some kind of collaborative relationship among school districts, for example, or among different groups of folks. That would be the only way in which that would be available. Is that correct?
Deputy Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, that's correct, because for instance, a school district in a rural area may have two new teachers or one new teacher, and it's better to deliver that in conjunction with a higher ed institution or a service cooperative, because they may not have the numbers of teachers to actually deliver on-site. And so what we've done actually with the program now in certain areas is work in a regional area, and then we cover a number of school districts working together and delivering the service, just because they may not have the numbers at each school district to support a whole program.
Oh, thank you.
Representative Powerson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is back on the SCRED page. And I understand that there is a match program for private dollars going into the AmeriCorps on a 5-to-1 ratio from the federal government, but I don't know the fine details of that. Do you know more about that?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Fowles, the Serve Minnesota program does raise private funds, and I would really refer those questions to the executive director, Audrey Suker. She could answer exactly how much private funding they've raised and how much federal dollars that is leveraged. But the state funding does leverage also federal funds.
And, Representative Faust.
No, just a thing.
Oh. I have had a chance to, with Audrey Zucker, have a tour of part of this program, the part that's in Woodbury, and it was very impressive. So I'm sure when we talk about this more in detail, she will be here to tell us about it. They even have a video and so forth, so we can learn more. All right. Please proceed.
Okay, I think we're on page 81, which is expansion of the educational planning and assessment system. This was a system put in place in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
It is done with ACT. It's a voluntary program. Students take an assessment in 8th grade and in 10th grade. In 8th grade, it helps them plan for high school. It also gives them their strengths and weaknesses in certain areas and also does some predictability how students will score on the ACT. And then in 10th grade, they go back in and take a look again at the student and make sure they're prepared for the ACT and for post-secondary. This is a voluntary assessment program, and in its first and second year, we've had almost 100% participation in grade 10 and close to 80% participation in grade 8, and we're basically need additional funding to ensure that we can allow 100% participation for both grades 8 and 10. So the governor is recommending $464,000 each year to make sure that we get to 100% participation. Page 82 is a recommendation for a statewide assessment program. The governor is recommending additional funding for very specific additions to our testing program. Right now, we deliver a summative once-a-year assessment. Normally, that testing window is in April of each year. It's a system check assessment that's aligned to our Minnesota standards. And the governor is recommending additional spending in this area for these specific items. One is an online computer-based reporting tool for teachers. Right now, it's very haphazard how data is put together. Sometimes teachers have to go back and get paper copies of the students' scores to analyze that. What this would do is provide an online web-based secure tool that would give classroom teachers rights-based access to view assessment history for their students. So they would have that data at their in their classroom, be able to view that and use that data. The second item that the governor recommends is that in 2005, just some history, the legislature repealed the basic skills test, which was given in grade 8. The reason they did that was to eliminate some state testing, and also because there was a lot of testing going on in grade 8, so there was concern that we were testing our 8th graders too much, because in 8th grade they would have had to take an assessment in reading, in math, and in science. And in replace of the state graduation requirement, we have moved to the grad test. And that test, what we've done is it's two tests in one. So in 9th grade, they take a writing test, which is the state requirement. It's not a federal requirement. In 10th grade, when they take the MCA test, a subset of questions will be embedded into that test for graduation purposes. And so they're basically taking two tests in one. They're taking the MCA test for the accountability system, and then they're taking, they also have within that test a subset of questions for their state graduation requirements. Those are two different different things we're testing in that case. Those students that do not pass the grad test, what we are recommending is that we deliver an online computer-based graduation retest for those students that would be available to districts to decide the retest calendar, and they would have an opportunity to lock the student into the system for a retest no sooner than 6 weeks, and that would be determined by the local school or school district. What this will do is increase the number of opportunities available for those retests to occur for those students that do not pass the state grad test. The third item is additional money for alignment of the Minnesota tests to the Minnesota standards. In 2003, the legislature repealed the profile learning standards, replaced that with grade-specific standards in reading, math, science, and social studies. What happens when the standards change is we have to change the tests to those standards. And that is quite a cumbersome process that involves very detailed item development that has to happen. Minnesota teachers come in and work with the department and with our vendor to develop items for the assessment, and then those items get field tested on our state tests, and then we review those items to see if it's appropriate to keep them for future tests or discard them. We call that our bias review. We take a look at the data behind how students performed on those items. And what is needed, item development is very expensive in testing. Right now we are on a 6-year revision cycle for our standards, And so as we revise our standards, we may have to revise the test depending on how much the standards are changed. Professor Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think it's a great idea that you're doing two tests in one to reduce the amount of testing. Do you still test at the 8th grade level, or has the standard risen more to a 10th grade level for the graduation test? And then if you're giving it later, do you see or do you worry about having less time available for kids who are behind to actually get that remediation to actually graduate on time?
Deputy Commissioner. Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the grad test is probably just slightly more difficult than the BSC. And it was a test that about 90% of our Minnesota students passed on the first time in the 8th grade. So we're dealing, when we have to retest on those, those students, it's a smaller pool of students that need to retest. The reason why we want to go to computer-based is because then we can deliver more opportunities than if we stayed with the paper-pencil administration. And so right now at the window, at the specific time with the paper-pencil administration, and if we move to computerized online, the district could decide when that retest happens with the student, but they'd have to have 6 weeks before they could retest again. So they couldn't just continuously retest constantly. There'd be 6 weeks before they could go in and retest. And so we think if we go with this computerized online, there would be enough opportunities for those students to be ready to graduate. And then also they're taking the test later, so that does, in eighth grade, so it does give them additional years to be ready when they take the test. It is very possible that a student could be partially proficient on the MCA assessment and pass the grad test. You'll probably never see a situation where they're proficient on the MCA and fail the grad test, because the grad test questions are much easier than the MCA questions.
Could you give us a breakdown of the 2,000 or the money up there at the top for the three components?
Madam Chair, I do not have that breakdown with me right now. Is that something that I could deliver to you and the committee members at a later point?
That would be.
I don't want to give out misinformation.
Yeah, if you could get that to us, that would be greatly appreciated.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
The fourth item, if you go to page 84, is another recommendation for the testing program. One item that we consistently receive as feedback on the testing program is the need for a formative diagnostic assessment. And right now, the assessment that we give is a summative assessment that's required to be that in nature by the federal requirements that we have on us through the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. What this would provide is funding to develop a formative diagnostic assessment aligned to our state standards and thus aligned to our summative assessment that would be voluntary for schools and districts to administer in a time frame they would want to administer it. It'd also be the data used would be kept at the local school district. It would not be used for our reporting purposes. It would be used as an instructional tool for Minnesota teachers to get quick and diagnostic feedback for their students when they're during the school year before they take that summative assessment, and really help assist with where their students are at before they take the summative assessment MCAs in the spring.
Representative Abney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Assistant Commissioner Anderson. When will we know that we're testing students enough?
Deputy Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Abney, this proposal here is voluntary for schools. Many schools use a local assessment for diagnostic purposes. And if they choose to want to continue to use those assessments, they can continue doing so. The state is not telling them that they should use this, but the feedback we get from schools is that they like the diagnostic assessment, but the problem is that we have right now with the different assessments being used is that there's not an alignment with our Minnesota standards. And so this is just an opportunity if the schools would like to use the state, if you should adopt this, they could use the state formative assessment whenever they would want to, or they could continue using their local standardized assessment.
And then I know the federal government requires us to do the summative tests like the MCA2s, but we hear a lot when we go out in our districts about using the formative tests, the NWEAs and so forth. And this then would give districts at least some money for aligning the standards, but they really would still have to give the others because of the federal requirements. Do you know of any, do you think there'll ever be any movement on the federal level, or will we always be left with having to do the two tests?
Madam Chair, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, or known as No Child Left Behind, is up for reauthorization right now.
Mm-hmm.
We expect that to be finalized in 2008. The only movement we've seen in this area is allowing states to use some sort of growth model with their summative assessment. Minnesota is very interested in that option. We actually did receive money from the 2005 legislature to implement a growth model, and we were in process of doing that. The reason why Minnesota could not apply this year, because you need to have at least 2 years of data, consecutive year testing data, in order to even be eligible to apply. And Minnesota's first baseline year for grades 3 through 8 in reading and math was just this past spring. So we need another year before we can apply to be part of that model that the federal government has put forth. So we do see some movement area. I have no idea. I have no glass ball to predict what Congress will do, but we know that the act needs to be reauthorized sometime in 2008.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair,
we would
next be moving to the special education article, Article 3, on page 171. The governor is recommending that special education funding be increased by 2% the first year of the biennium and an additional 2% in the second year of the biennium, consistent with his recommendation for general education funding. We have three major programs for special education funding. We have the special education regular account, we have the special education excess cost account, and we have the transition disabled account. All three of those are programs that have a cap on them at the state level, and the governor's recommendation would increase the caps by 2% the first year and an additional 2% the second year. The total cost of doing that is on page 171, and that's $11,087,000 in fiscal 08 and $24,174,000 in fiscal 09, with tails of about $26 million for each year.
Dr. Melcher, how much would that make up for the cuts to special education? And when I say cuts, I mean not having those inflationary factors in there.
Madam Chair, the total funding for special education is currently set at about $530 million for the regular account. So if you were to take 4% of $530 million, I'd have to do some quick math there, but we would be short that amount for each of the last 2 years. So just off the top of my head here, I'm having trouble without a calculator.
Well, we're expecting you to do the math quicker than us.
Okay, 40. I think I heard 40-some million here. So it would be about $40 million a year that it would take to do a 4% increase, which is about the rate that the costs have been growing. And so what this does at 2% a year is it's reducing the continued growth of the cross subsidy for special education, but it's not actually buying down the growth that we've experienced in the previous biennium.
So in other words, Dr. Melcher, the cross subsidy, even with this, will still be growing.
Madam Chair, yes. The projections have been that the cost of special education is growing about 4% a year, and the governor's funding about 2% a year.
Mm.
And so with a 2% a year increase, you can see we're putting in about $34 million. So you'd have to basically just about double that in order to maintain the cross subsidy at the current level, and then if you wanted to make up for prior issues, that would be on top of that.
It's a big problem. Thank you.
Madam Chair, in addition to providing the 2% and 2% increases in special education funding, the governor is recommending some restructuring of the special education funding package to make it more uniform. Currently, we have the special education regular account and we have the transition disabled account. The transition disabled account is a kind of a hybrid between career technical education and special education. It requires a dual licensure both in special education and in career technical education. It is part of the overall package of special education services that are provided to students with disabilities. It is counted as part of the maintenance of effort requirements that when we look at whether a school district is maintaining effort or whether the state is maintaining effort for special education. So really, in our view, it's part of the overall package that the state provides for special education funding. And in statute, the funding formula for career technical education or transition disabled is nearly identical to the special education regular formula. The state funding is theoretically 68% of the salary of the teacher, plus some additional amount for supplies and equipment, and there's a travel piece in there as well. So those categories are the same. But because both the special ed account and the transition disabled account have been capped, and because the growth in the two accounts has been different, what we found is that the special education regular account is being prorated at a lower level than the transition disabled account. So that would be, at first blush, an advantage for the transition disabled program over the regular special ed program. But on the other hand, we have the special education excess cost aid as well, and the special education cost aid applies only to the regular program and not to the transition disabled program. So I think what we've got here is a system that's a little more complicated than it needs to be, and that creates some inequities between the school districts that have a relatively high mix of transition disabled programs as opposed to special education regular programs. So to try to simplify things just a little bit and to make the funding more uniform among these different subcomponents of the overall special education program, the governor is recommending that we combine the caps for the two programs and make both programs eligible for the special education excess cost aid so that a school district would receive the same reimbursement for a teacher in the regular special education program and the teacher in the transition disabled program if they had the same salary level. And I think that would be viewed by most people as being the most equitable way to fund these two programs.
We have a question from Representative Benson.
I'm just curious, what was the year maybe and the percentage when state funding for special education hit its apex? We're at, 72% now? Or so? What is the number now, and when had it reached as high as 92%, and if so, when?
Not Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, the state has long funded special education as a percentage of salaries, and up until from the mid-70s, I would say, until the mid-90s, we were funding somewhere in the neighborhood of 68 to 70% of the cost of the teacher salary. And we also provided 47%, some years it had been as high as 50% of the cost of special supplies. And it was in the mid to late 90s that we began funding, instead of funding the current year cost, we began funding a cost on a second prior year basis. So you see a little bit of a slippage there because we're funding 68% of the cost from 2 years ago rather than the current cost, which would be higher. And more recently, the state has enacted caps on the special education funding, but we have up until the 2003 session, we provided an inflation adjustment so that we capped the program, but we provided an inflation adjustment so that the actual funding level was very close to that 68% of salary. So we were, in effect, capping but funding at a level close to full funding. Because of the elimination of the inflation factor by the 2003 legislature, we went into a period where the costs were growing at about 4% a year. Funding was flat. There wasn't a reduction in funding, but it just simply wasn't growing. And as a result of that, kind of the effective proration rate has been going down by about 4% a year for the last couple of years. In 2005, the special education formula was prorated at about 88% of the full, 88% of 68%. Last year it was about 84%. This year we're projecting about 79%. Next year, if there were no increase, we'd be about 76%. So essentially what's happening is funding is flat, costs are growing at 4%, and you just get a bigger difference between the two, And what the governor's recommendation does is it narrows that difference by about half by providing a 2% increase each year.
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I can understand this disabilities transition programs, is this disabilities with children that have language barriers or physical barriers?
Madam Chair and no. Representative Dominguez, these are students with disabilities. They would, in some cases, have physical barriers. They may have emotional issues. They may have low IQ kinds of issues. So you have a variety of different kinds of disabling conditions that the students would face. A student that simply has limited English proficiency would not be included here unless they had other disabling conditions.
Okay. One follow-up, Madam Chair. Would this also be children that are deaf or blind?
Dr. Mel.
Madam Chair and Representative Dominguez, yes. So that would be an example of a physical condition that would lead to the student being considered a student with a disability and eligible for these services. And the purpose of the special education funding is to provide funding for the excess cost, for the additional cost of serving these students over and above the cost of serving a student in the regular program. These students are counted just like any other student is counted for the general education funding. And then the excess cost, kind of the theory was, we're going to cover maybe a third of the cost of serving these students with the regular general education program, and then we're going to cover two-thirds of the salary for that special education teacher because that was viewed as an excess cost. So the theory was one-third of that teacher's salary is coming from the general ed program, and the other two-thirds is coming from the special education funding package.
I think now we'll have Dr. Melcher finish up the special ed section, and I think I'll try Chair Mariani's tactic from his committee. We'll go through each section and only have questions at the end. Maybe we can pick up the pace a little bit,
okay.
But we do want to have questions answered. All right, Dr. Melcher, it's yours till you get done with special ed.
Okay, so Madam Chair, what we've said so far is we've increased the funding by 2% each year, and the governor's recommended combining the funding for transition disabled and special education regular with one cap so that we have a uniform rate of proration and also applying the excess cost aid uniformly to the two. The third change the governor's recommending is to roll the separate funding for Part C students, those are for 0 to 2-year-old students, into the regular special education and excess cost accounts. You may recall that during the last legislative session, there was a placeholder created for expansion of the Part C programs because the Federal Department of Education, after an audit or a monitoring visit of the Department of Education here in Minnesota, determined that our present criteria for allowing students into the Part C were not consistent with federal law. The Minnesota currently requires the students to have more than one area of developmental delay, and the U.S. Department of Education ruled that we needed to allow students with one area of developmental delay to be included, and also students who had a high probability of delay that were currently not being included. So as a result of that, Minnesota is in the process of revising its rules for Part C, and that will increase the number of students that are age 0 to 2 who are eligible for these preschool special education services in the state of Minnesota. We had a placeholder set up in last year's budget, but there really wasn't a funding mechanism that was specified in law to deal with that. In reviewing this as part of the November budget forecast, we determined that these students were very similar to other students who are 0 to 2 who are currently being served, and that the current state law as it relates to general education funding would include these students. And so the November budget forecast does include funding for those students in the general education program. In order to implement the separate placeholder that was put in law last year, the department in doing the forecast determined that it would be most appropriate to use the same funding mechanism that we use for other students who are 0 to 2 who are currently funded through the regular and excess cost special education funding formula. So the current forecast is reflecting the assumption that those students would receive the same 68% of salaries and contract costs and so forth as are provided for other children of the same age group. What the governor is recommending here is that rather than having another funding mechanism that's kind of parallel and floats out there, to roll that funding into the regular special ed formula and the excess cost formula, and that will just eliminate by one the number of separate categories and provide the same funding level that we currently provide.
Very good. Any questions on special ed? Facilities and technology. We'll wait till the end for questions on this one as well, but feel free to get on the list if you do have questions.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Anderson. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the governor is recommending $19 million each year to improve school technology capacity and increase the use of online learning technology in schools. One of the things is Department of Education actually has done an audit of school districts as it relates to technology. That report is available on our website. We can also forward that to you, but it's not surprising that, number one, there's no statewide standards for technology across schools, so as we look to increase technology in schools and use consortiums of schools to deliver technology, unless there's statewide the same statewide standards, it's very hard to deliver those services. The second thing is just capacity for everything from T1 lines to computers to related software technology. There is a need for schools to upgrade their technology, and so the governor is recommending using the one-time funds available from the surplus for $19 million in the first year and in the second year to provide additional funding for schools to upgrade their technology.
Madam Chair and members, moving to page 203, we have the governor's recommendation for job zone definitions for debt service. When I was here yesterday, we talked a little bit about a minor change dealing with operating referendums. This is a similar sort of thing dealing with debt service. We currently have a very complicated system for calculating the debt service aid for school districts because we have most of the debt service levies are bonded debt, and for bonded debt, the job zone properties are not exempt from paying the same taxes as other properties. However, there are a couple of small levies in the debt service fund, including energy loans and lease purchase levies, where the job zone properties are exempt. And so it creates a need to go through all of the debt service calculations twice, and it makes things very complicated with almost no impact on the net results. So what the governor is recommending is that we require the job zone properties to pay the same taxes on all of the debt service levies uniformly to not exempt them from these two small categories of debt service levies. So what you see is a very small increase in the tax burden on job zone properties from this one, which is pretty well offset by the very small reduction in the operating referendum category. And the end result is a much simpler set of calculations.
Libraries.
For libraries, the governor is recommending for basic support a 2% increase each year. The funding for library basic support has not been increased since 1991, and the governor felt it was appropriate to provide the same, again, 2% increase that he's provided in other areas of the budget for the basic support of libraries.
I'm glad the governor's interested in libraries, and I noticed the speaker introduced the bill today. So we have finally libraries are maybe going to end their drought. Next section. Oh, we're still on libraries.
Madam Chair, continuing on the libraries proposal, this is a request for $200,000 in fiscal year 08 to conduct a statewide comprehensive library study. Right now, we have a very complicated system of multi-types and regionals, academic, school, public, and special libraries. And just this is sort of part of the governor's Drive to Excellence initiative to see if there's efficiencies in the system in delivering technology and services. We're requesting funding to have an outside entity review our library system and make recommendations to the department and the legislature if there are any changes that should be made.
And with regard to the Minnesota Library for the Blind, this is just an information-only item here. There is a small amount of money being carried in the Office of Enterprise Technology budget to enable the Library for the Blind to update its software and to provide a recording booth upgrade at the Library for the Blind.
I have one question. That library study, did the library organizations request that, or what was the genesis of the study recommendation.
Madam Chair, there's been a lot of discussions about looking at the system for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And initially we did instigate a stakeholders group with the thought that the department would conduct the study. We feel that it would be better for an outside independent entity mm-hmm. to do that and would provide more objectivity than probably we could provide, because essentially these libraries are our customers. And it would probably be better for an outside entity to make that recommendation. We will continue to work with our stakeholders, our regional libraries, our multi-type libraries in this process, but we just felt it was better for someone on the outside to conduct the study. Thank you. Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell us what you consider a special library?
The Minnesota Library for the Blind is a special library that, for example, would have books that are in Braille. It's located in Faribault, where the State Academy for the Blind is located, and provides services for the students there. But it also provides statewide services for adults and students from other schools that are visually impaired. So it's special ways of formatting information so that people with visual impairments are able to enjoy and get information.
And Madam Chair, I believe they also have books on tape and things and those sort of things as well. It's a variety mm-hmm. of materials they supply to those that are visually impaired.
Rep. Mariani.
Madam Chair, thank you. I know this is like a very basic 101 question, but I really don't know the answer. How do I differentiate this with school libraries? How do we deal with school libraries in terms of funding and support?
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, the funding for school libraries is, for the most part, handled through the general education program. When schools generate a certain amount of money per pupil unit, the local school board would then decide how much of that they want to put into the library versus the classroom instruction and so forth.
Okay.
All right. And now, members, the rest of what we have in our section here is early childhood. You can read those for your information, but that's another committee. So Mr. Crow tells me that we now skip to page 310, which is the tab under agency.
Madam Chair, is that starting on page 314? Is that correct?
Yep. 314, okay. Okay, page 314, Department of Education Operations, Rulemaking Authority for Grad.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, members of the committee, the governor is recommending $204,000 in fiscal year 08, which is generally the cost of promulgating rules. The department only has limited rulemaking authority in specific areas. And as the legislature repealed the BST, we need to promulgate rules for the grad test in order to be specific about testing requirements, uniform retest opportunities, parental and student rights as it becomes available for retests and the tests. And this is a very normal process that we put these procedures into rule and not statute.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you want questions at the end, but I couldn't resist asking this one, so thank you.
Representative Erickson, you haven't been taking up any of the committee's time, so you go right ahead.
I'm letting Representative Heigerken put, you know. I relinquish all my time to him. Commissioner Anderson, rulemaking continues to increase in cost. So can you just give us a glimpse of what's involved in the increasing cost of rulemaking? Legal fees, et cetera.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, this is just a general number that's given to us, but generally a rulemaking process involves 15 to 18 months of having public hearings, of having the Office of Administrative Hearing support. We have to pay them for the time and the revisor and just providing copies to the public. And so this is just a general number that's given to us as to the cost. It could be less, it could be more, but this is just the average of what they say it will cost if you go into full rulemaking. There is expedited rulemaking, but Generally, it has to be very non-controversial to survive expedited rulemaking.
And I have, well, go ahead. I want to ask generally about rulemaking, too, but why don't you finish up so we can be on the home run here.
All right, Madam Chair, the next recommendation is for rulemaking authority for career and technical education. As we've changed the levy for career and technical education, and there's been several reauthorizations of what's known as the Perkins Act, we have not updated our rules in over 20 years. There's a lot of new terminology and new programming that's happening in career and technical education, and so the department is recommending authority and funding to update those rules.
Okay. Oh, keep going, because there's one more page on rulemaking.
And then page 317 is the salary supplement or adjustment, compensation adjustment for the Department of Education. Generally, most state agencies in the governor's budget received a 2-2 salary supplement increase. That increase would amount to $320,000 for fiscal year 08 and $647,000 for fiscal year 2009. And this is to pay for what's going to come forward, and that's the state employee contract settlement that generally happens in the summer or fall of the year of this year.
And okay. Then I'm going to ask a question on rulemaking, and then I have Representative Silstrom on the list. We might get done early, but we do have extra time if people have questions. Representative Garofalo, we just add him to the list as well. My question is, and one of the early things I did when I was here in the legislature was chaired a subcommittee on administrative rulemaking, and in fact, the expedited rulemaking was my legislation, and it was meant for very simple things. So I've been amazed at some of the comprehensive, very thorny topics that have been given expedited rulemaking. But in any case, we always try, though, to do whatever we can here in the legislature, because we're the ones accountable to the public for what goes on. And if we have rulemaking, then we delegate our authority to the agencies, and oftentimes we legislators hear from the public about rules, and we can't remember that we passed anything like that, and we wonder where that came from, and it was always an agency rule. So I learned to be very cautious about what we delegate out, and as opposed to what we just do right here in the legislature. And I'm wondering why we need rulemaking for these two topics. Is there any way to recommend language this year that we could just pass, and then we would have legislative oversight right away?
Madam Chair, for the career and technical education, it's actually updating an existing rule. And so that one already exists in rule. We just simply want to update it. It hasn't been updated in about 20 years. The rule for the grad test, we did have a rule in place for the basic skills test, which this test replaced the basic skills test. And what we do is we put specific requirements that's needed for test security, clear instructions on delivering the administration of the test, how many retest opportunities we involve. And so this rule that we put in place would replace a rule that was repealed because we repealed the basic skills test. I think this is more important to put these sorts of things in rule rather than statute, just because sometimes the process helps, the 15 to 18 month process really helps weed out things that we thought were great and then passed into law and then said, oops, we really can't administer the test very well. And so the rulemaking process does allow us to bring in more time to consult with stakeholders, which is generally school districts that have to administer this rule. And if there are things that we find are not workable during the process, we can make those changes. And it just allows us more time to do that than the legislative process.
Any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hillstrom and Representative Garofalo after her.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tend to spend a lot of time looking into departments in particular, especially when I spent time on the in correction. And so I'm noticing on page 313 it says that there are 470, I believe, current full-time equivalents up from 400 in 06. Is there anywhere in the budget that kind of talks about exactly what that is or what they do or who that's made up from so that I can understand who they are and what they do?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we'd be happy to provide you with that information. I'm just looking at this page myself. For the Department of Education operations, the 470 FTEs, I have to tell you, I don't think that's correct. Okay. I think we have more like 410.
Okay.
So I'm going to have this take a look at it and update it, because I can tell you we don't have 470 FTEs. That's not correct.
Okay.
But we'd be happy to provide just information generally of the divisions that we have in the department and how many employees in each division and what their general functions would be.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just brought that up because I thought that there was a dramatic growth between 400 to 470 in 1 year.
Yeah.
Is that, did you want a question or an answer? That was it. Okay. I thought they were pondering, trying to answer your question there. Representative Garofalo.
Well, Madam Chair, this has to do with the topic I discussed with you before our committee. It's not an appropriate time for that.
Representative Garofalo, I think this is the perfect time.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, yesterday I had asked some questions about the history of the general education funding shift, and I was 99% sure that the answer we were given in committee was not complete, but I wanted to make 100% sure, because if you're just a lowly second-term member, you don't challenge the highly respected members who are people who are testifying before us. But my recollection was, and was correct, that the general education shift originated with the Minnesota Miracle in the early 70s. And the question I had based on that originally was that why did they put that into place? And I believe the answer you gave was that for student aid counts, technology back then was less than accurate. We wanted to make sure we didn't have to come back to people and take their money back. So my question is, right now with the Department of Education, when is pupil unit data updated from the individual school districts?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, for a number of years now, the department has been on an individual student-by-student database. So we're getting individual student records from the school districts. We're making aid payments during the year based on estimates that the school districts make of their aggregate student counts that they provide us during the summer, and we begin payments at that time. School districts are allowed to update those estimates at any time throughout the year. And so we encourage districts to do that so that we can be paying them based on the latest information. The final data comes in when the school year is over, and the school districts by law have until December 31st to make their final last-minute changes. Although we try to get most of that information in August and September, because the bulk of the state aid dollars go out in September and October, and we want to try to get 99.9% of the money out in September and October, and then we have some late cleanup that we do quite often. If you have some students that have moved around between districts and they've got one here and one there that need to be corrected.
And Madam Chair, so the answer I'm hearing is that the process we use now is different than it was when this plan was originally implemented. Is that a correct statement?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, when I came to the department in the late 70s, we had a paper process. We got estimates from the school districts. They'd send in some paper reports at the end of the year, and there was a lot of reconciling that had to be done, and quite honestly, we got much better, more accurate data when we went to the individual student process, where we were able to do cross-checking. So in other words, if you've got one school district that's reported a student, and you've got another school district that's reported the same student, we actually can check and make sure they're not reporting that same student for the same. We were able to really clean things up in the mid-90s, and as a result of that, we have a much more up-to-date, more accurate system than we had years ago.
Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, so with the exception of the factor of political will, is there any factors that you are aware of that would prevent us from increasing that 90% payment, to use the term of another member, to eliminate the Enron accounting that we are using? Is there, with the exception of political will, are you aware of any factor that would prevent us from increasing it above the 90% level?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Grappolot, there are still going to be some differences between what the school districts have estimated and what the final numbers end up being. For a program like general education, where it's based on student counts, you know, I think that it would be very possible to go to a 95% level, for example. I think there are probably very few school districts that have an error of more than 5% in their numbers. To go to 100%, I think, could be problematic. We'd be taking money away and paying it back. I think there are some other programs where the funding is driven not by numbers of students but by expenditures during the fiscal year, and those might be a little bit problematic. One that comes to mind is the special education excess cost formula, where you may have heard that school districts have difficulty even having the final information in November when they're closing their books due to some of the movement of students back and forth across school district boundaries. So that one I might be a little more uncomfortable going to that level than I would with something like general ed that's based on students.
Well, Madam Chair, to our members of the committee, thanks to the testifier for answering those questions. One of the concerns I've had is that the 90-10 formula really is an outdated mode of financial payments, and I think that we can move beyond 90%. We can move up for more honest accounting of things. Earlier in the committee, we did talk about how this is factoring in the cash balances and the operating funds for the school districts, and what we can dispute where it is that above 90 we should go. But I do think it would be important if this committee, as part of its deliberations, were to move beyond the 90 level, because many of our more senior members think that the 90% level is the full payment for education, and as we know, that is from testimony, that's not true. So thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Grappolo. I think he was talking to me.
No.
All right. Well, members, we have finished early, and I compliment you very much. We had a lot of rich and very good questions, but yet we're done early. I just want to make one last announcement. Members, if I could have your attention for just one more minute. The bus leaves on Tuesday. We will not have committee, since you've been so very efficient, but we will leave to go to Representative Dominguez's district at the bus will be at the east steps of the state office building at 6 o'clock. We'll depart at 6:15. We will depart from North Minneapolis to come back here at 8:45. On Wednesday, we will go through the other agency budgets, which will be the Perpich Center for the Arts and the schools in Faribault. And then we're still working on Thursday. The following, we have two options. One might be PS Minnesota, or we might start on property taxes. We will have to see because we are debating on that. The next week we will be hearing, starting to hear bills. And so if you have bills that you want heard on some of our important topics, I urge you to work on them as fast as you can, because we're going to start looking at some of our big topics like special education, all day, every day, kindergarten, world language, a lot of the topics in the governor's budget. We hope to make a big centerpiece and then hear the governor's bills as well as your alternative bills. So please work on your bills, get them in as soon as possible so they can fit in where they make sense. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.